Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 23rd, 2010, and this is show number 261. Well, let's get year six started, shall we? Well, last week when Nightwise was on the show, before we started our official recording, I caught a little tidbit I thought you might enjoy. There's no real value to this clip. I just thought it was really funny. Right before I started recording, he had started talking about peacocks in his neighbor's yard. Let's pick it up right there.
We have our next door neighbor, the neighbor who lives behind us. His backyard is adjacent to our backyard, and he has two. And he has a goose. So the goose is like a super, super sensitive alarm system, all right? Anything farts in a five-mile area, that thing just goes quack. And that's the only thing it does. It just goes quack once. And then immediately these two peacocks he has go like quack, quack, quack. And oh, man, it's nice, especially 4:30 in the morning at summertime.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They really like morning, don't they?
Yeah, quack, quack, quack. Oh, God.
Now, wow. Are BB guns legal where you are?
Yeah, but I have to live to the next door neighbor. I mean, I can shoot his peacocks, but it will be kind of suspicious.
Because he's the only one within range.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard. I mean, he has a lot of shrubbery around.
Oh, so you don't have a clean shot?
I don't have a clean shot. I could, as I said, a photon torpedo would take out the yard.
And the neighbor as well, so that would then you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you know, charges, prison, stuff like that.
Blah, blah, blah.
I've heard bandwidth's kind of poor on death row, so I've kind of...
Well, luckily, I did not offer you any sort of belief that that was going to be of any value whatsoever, but I still liked it. Bandwidth is bad in death row. Maybe that's a good title for the show. Well, Louis Trapani of the Doctor Who Podshock podcast sent in a funny little recording about my five-year anniversary. Let's take a listen to that right now.
Louis Trapani here. It's by some coincidence I find myself wishing a happy fifth anniversary to the NoSillaCast. It is the fifth anniversary of my podcast to Doctor Who Podshock this summer. Coincidence or not? Both podcasts feature someone from across the pond on a regular basis. Coincidence or not? NoSillaCast is hosted on podfeet.com. Doctor Who Podshock is hosted on podshock.net. Coincidence or not? I have been told if I drop the H from Podshock and add an S, I would have pod socks for Allison's pod feet. Coincidence or not? Allison and I both have known TMA Steve Stanger for years, yet have never met in person. Coincidence or not? I met Allison for the first time in 2008, which was the first time I went to the New Media Expo in Las Vegas, which was the first time she went to the New Media Expo in Las Vegas. Coincidence or not? Okay, it was the first time the New Media Expo was in Las Vegas, but that's besides the point. I've been using Mac since 1991, and Allison has been using Mac since 1991. Coincidence or not? Okay, I just made that up. I have no idea when Allison started using Macs. Hey, Allison may share birthdays with her soulmate, but since our podcasts share birth years, does that make them podmates? Actually, I have not been listening to the NoSillaCast from the beginning. I first heard Allison on the Mac Roundtable podcast. Even after meeting Allison 2 years ago, at that time I was so backed up with unplayed podcast episodes, I'm talking hundreds here, I promised myself no new podcast subscriptions until I get that number down. Then Allison mentioned something to me about a Doctor Who promo for Honda Bob. I asked, what is a Honda Bob? Well, that's when everything changed. I broke my rule I had set for myself and began listening to the NoSillaCast. I haven't missed a show yet since that time. I have to admit, though, the first time I heard Allison on the Mac Roundtable, she was asking everyone so many questions on the show that at first it made me wonder why she was on it, until I realized by asking all those questions, she was in fact helping listeners. Congratulations to Allison for 5 years of the NoSillaCast. Thanks for bringing the show to us each week. And more importantly, thanks for your friendship. By the way, we both have Nikon DSLR cameras. Coincidence or not?
Well, that was great, Lewis. That was fantastic. The chat room was getting really scared with all the amazing coincidences. They were throwing salt over the shoulder, grabbing wooden crosses. It was wild, I tell you. It was wild, the coincidences. Anyway, congratulations to you, too. Well, you may remember a few weeks ago, I asked for your help in figuring out why I couldn't get my iPad or iPhone to pick up my calendars from my Mobile Me account. I tried everything I could think of to fix it, and I pulled in Katie Floyd of the Mac Power Users, because she's so much smarter than I am about this kind of stuff, and she tried to help but couldn't figure it out, didn't crack the code. Then I pulled in the big guns. I wrote to the Mac Geek Gab with John F. Braun and Dave Hamilton. I figure that was the last plea I needed to make. I mean, those guys know everything, right? And yet, they came up dry. Well, who do you go to when these guys can't figure it out? I was desperate, so I got a crazy idea. I called Apple. I know it was a whacked plan, but what did I have to lose? I wasn't sure where the issue was, since my Mac had the calendar and contact data, and Mobile Me had it too. It was clearly syncing just fine, but it would not show up on the iPad and the iPhone. I'd always assumed it was something I was doing wrong on the iPhone, but I somehow replicated that exact error on the iPad. Anyway, on a dare, I called AppleCare. Quite quickly, they said, the people to help me would have to be the Mobile Me people who are only available by live chat. That's cool, though. I like text chatting rather than talking to real humans these days anyway. The guy on the phone directed me exactly where to find the live chat on the Apple website, and I was instantly rewarded with Jeff B. asking me, how can I help? I told him up front that I was a sophisticated user, so jump to the hard questions. He and I went back and forth for a while, and pretty soon he started saying things like, hang on, checking something, quite a few times. Finally, he told me that every time I tried to sync my devices, something on the server side would lock me out. He had to do several diagnostic steps, but we didn't succeed in solving the problem. Jeff B. gave me a case number and assured me that I would be contacted in the next 24 to 48 hours. Now, I think for most people, most problems, that would probably be a hideous length of time to have to wait, but since I've never successfully synced these devices, another couple of days was not really that big of a deal to me. The last thing he did was offer to email me a transcript of our conversation on chat. I thought that was way cool. Even though, of course, I'd already printed the chat window to a PDF, I still thought it was a good thing for them to offer, so I went ahead and said yes, and I got in an email a short while later. Well, back when Katie was helping me, she had me do a bunch of different things, including resetting my sync history. This is important to the plot because of what comes next. 2 days after I chatted with Jeff B., my new friend Lee, the mobile senior advisor, wrote to me about my issue. His opening line was to tell me to reset my sync history. And I started off by giving him a hard time for not reading what I'd written to Jeff B. because I already did reset my sync history, and that Jeff B. told me it was a problem on the server. But since I had time on my hands, I decided to reread what he wrote, and that's when I realized that he had a slightly different order of events in his suggestion. I'll give the top-level order of what he told me to do, but his instructions were super detailed. He said, back up the Mobile Me data on my Mac, unregister the computers on my account, which, by the way, Jeff B. had had me do too, then restart the computer, then reset the sync history, then sync, making sure to push from the Mac over to Mobile Me. It was interesting that he had that exact order of events, because I'd done every single step in that chain, but not in that exact order. Lee told me to expect that I might see some sync conflicts and to keep answering, always push the data from the Mac to Mobile Me. He was right. I got those things a few times, and in the end, it fixed my problem. I now have my calendar, and actually a few other things were boogered up too, but I have them all on my iPad, my iPhone. I can create events anywhere, and they show up everywhere. He told me that something had gotten corrupted in my data along the way and that this would clean everything up. I do still have some issues. My bookmarks are finally syncing from my Mac to my iPad and iPhone, which wasn't a critical piece, but it's kind of nice to have. But I've got like 8 different copies on the mobile devices, so I still have some more resetting to do. But for now, I'm confident I'll be able to figure that out because I can just follow these steps a little more detailed. I thought you'd want closure on all of this, and hopefully someone will hear or read this, and they'll move forward just a bit faster at resolution than I did. Thanks to all who tried to help, and thanks to AppleCare for solving the problem.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I is.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Chris from Australia sent in a dumb question. Hello, Allison. I have a question that I suppose a lot of people but me would consider really dumb. You might consider using it on a future podcast. Why I'm doing that? The problem. I've been following Bart's search for a capable Twitter client with some interest, which started me thinking, what is this Twitter thing? Yeah, that's right. Up until just recently, I did not use Twitter. Call it slow or old? So what I did was download Nambu, created a Twitter account, and started following some popular media sites in Australia. The question, is there a tutorial on Twitter and the terms used? Something like Twitter 101 or Twitter for Dummies, or alternatively, how would you suggest becoming confident with Twitter? I'd like to know about the terms direct, mentioned, retweets, how to use URL shortening, how to attach images to tweets, etc. Regards, Chris W. in Sydney, Australia. Well, hey, Chris, I'm glad you asked. I bet there are tutorials out there, but I'd rather just tell you what I think. Twitter is one of the weirdest technologies. When you try to explain it to someone, they look at you like you forgot to take your medication. So here's a few key tips. Think of your Twitter account as a blog. It's a blog that only lets you write a very few characters for each post, 140 characters to be exact. If you write a blog, you really want people to read it, right? You hope people find your writing fascinating and the number of people reading you goes up and up and up. Twitter is the same way. You want people to follow you, which means they go out of their way to make sure they read what you write. Many people earlier in their tweeting journey worry about people following them as though they're stalking them like crazy listener James or something. It's not that at all. It just says that they find what you write interesting, as though you were writing a blog. Okay, that explains followers. Now you have to figure out who you want to follow. It looks like you found a few people, so you're right on the right track. You look for some people that interested you. But again, you're looking for people that you find interesting. I can't tell you who to follow because I don't know who you find interesting and what topics you find interesting. If you're interested in gardening or politics or religion or fashion or nuclear physics, you need to find people in those communities, maybe through their blogs or podcasts, and then follow them. Now, I follow people who like geek stuff, so you're interested in the same subject? Scroll through the two Twitter lists I have in the sidebar over at podfeet.com, and you can see all of the people who attend the live show of the NoSillaCast and the Mac Roundtable. They're all brilliant, of course. Read what those people are saying, and if you find someone interesting, follow them. Next up is the trickier parts of the terminology. So you're tweeting away, and random people around the world are reading your brilliant thoughts. What if you want to make sure a specific person reads what you say? How would you say, hey, read this? That's where you use the at symbol. So let's say I'm going to write something clever about my toenails, and I think Steve would really enjoy it. I would type into Twitter, at SP Sheridan, I'm clipping my toenails right now. When Steve looks at his Twitter client, he has three ways to read it. He can read the general stream of glop coming in from everyone he follows, or he can look at what are called the mentions, which are the tweets that have at SP Sheridan in them. I'll get to the third method in a minute. So anyone who puts at SP Sheridan in their tweet will cause it to show up in his mentions in this separate little pile. So you can follow a ton of people. I follow, I don't know, 400 people, but he can get just this little group of tweets that are when someone actually wants to catch his attention. Anyone can send you an at message whether you're following them or not. Now, think about a famous person, say David Pogue. He's at Pogue, and he works for the New York Times, by the way. Very clever, very funny. He probably gets thousands of these at messages every day. He has actually effectively used this to write an entire book entitled The World According to Twitter. He asked questions in Twitter and then collected all of the at replies he got into a pile and sorted out the good ones and made them into a book. My at reply is actually in there too. Now, onto the third way to get tweets. These are called direct tweets. Let's use the David Pogue example again. He's famous. He's got zillions of people at tweeting him all day long. So that's now pretty useless for actually communicating with people he really knows or finds interesting. Direct tweets can only be sent by someone that you are following. So since, say, Steve follows me, I can type D space SP Sheridan. That's how you send a direct tweet, D space, and then their Twitter name. And then I can put in a message. And it only goes to Steve. It's completely private. If I try to direct tweet David Pogue and he's not following me, it will not go through. So this is a good method to do private tweets and to make sure if someone has a ton of people following them, they'll still see your message. So we have plain old tweets, Mentions, which use the at symbol, and finally direct tweets with a D followed by a space. Now, the next question you asked about was retweets. Let's say I tweet something terribly clever, like the one I sent to Jeff Gamet when he mentioned how much he likes bacon. I at-tweeted him by saying at Jay Gamet, the pig is the perfect animal. It takes garbage and turns it into bacon. Jeff found this terribly inspiring, so he could have retweeted it, which means sending it out on his own Twitter account, but giving me recognition. There's several ways to do this, and there's actually no standard. One way is to put RT space at Podfeet at the beginning. Some clients put slash via at Podfeet at the end. Again, there's no standard way of doing it. Most Twitter clients will do this for you. You might right-click on a tweet, and there's a retweet option. Usually in the preferences, you can choose the format, but it doesn't really matter. It's just a visual tip of the hat to the originator. Nothing automatic happens with it like ats or ds. You know, those are very, very specific tools and things that happen. I've mentioned Twitter clients a bunch of times. It's way more fun to use a client than to go to twitter.com. Clients give you a much better experience. If you're on the Mac, you might want to check out Tweety, Echofon, and Nambu. There are tons of choices out there, and they're leapfrogging each other like crazy. For example, I just got a message during the live chat from Dan Eckmeyer that due to a lot of feedback from blind people with Nambu, they have addressed some of the accessibility issues they had, and they're making improvements right now. So the product is getting better and better, and that's really fun to see. If you have a smartphone, that's where the Twitter clients really come in handy. Having it with you when you're in line at the grocery store and you only have a few minutes where you need to be entertained, Twitter is great for that. Now, you mentioned URL shortening. That's also built into the clients now, so most of them will do it for you. It's necessary because we only get 140 characters, and some URLs by themselves can be longer than that, and how can you put in your clever commentary with it? Sending pictures and video is an advanced feature, but it is doable. There's multiple ways to do this as well, but for photos, I use a service called TwitPic. The way those kinds of services work is you register there with your Twitter name and password, and they give you an email address. You take a picture with your phone camera, for example, and then email it to that address. The subject you write becomes the tweet, and the picture is automatically attached as a URL to the tweet. That's kind of tricky because the email won't tell you if you've gone over your 140-character limit, so you got to be careful when you write in that little subject line. I use TwitVid on my iPhone, which is an application that lets you upload videos, again, something you register for with your Twitter name and password. That one doesn't use email, so it's actually a little better because I think the iPhone frequently stops you from sending videos because they're too big for your email from your iPhone. Well, this all sounds complicated and scary and weird when I put it all together like this. Remember I said at the beginning the part about people look like you didn't at you like you didn't take your medication? But let's back up a little bit and talk about what you can get out of Twitter. If you follow people of interest in your topic areas, you'll learn what's going on in the world in that subject. It is the fastest way to get information about earthquakes, tsunamis, and boys supposedly caught up in balloons and other disasters. But it's also the fastest way to hear about miracles like the landing of the jet on the Hudson. If you get a lot of followers, it's also a fantastic way to get people to help you. I post questions all the time. Like while I was writing this up, I was having a problem with a new Transmit 4 FTP client from Panic, so I wrote a question and someone from Panic helped me within about 5 minutes. Now, they weren't following me, but they evidently have a live search going for when people talk about their products, and I'm telling you, this turned me from throwing away the software again to loving it again because they were right there to be able to help me. Very smart move on their part. Jim Deverell in the chat room just said he used it once. He was having trouble with Gmail and he just tweeted, "Is Gmail down?" And boom, somebody answered and said, "Yep, it's down." I don't know when that was. That doesn't happen very often, but that is one way to do it. Now, Corell asks, how do you find out if Twitter goes down? Turns out there's a site called istwitterdown.com. So that's a pretty good one. All right. I feel like I've gained much more rich contact with people across the globe because of Twitter. I hope you find fun, friendly people who teach you and care about you like I've been able to find. You've heard me talk a lot about the ScreenSteps desktop software, but this week I came across a testimonial about ScreenSteps Live that was really interesting. ScreenSteps Live is a subscription service that you can buy that allows you to keep your lessons and manuals online with multiple contributing authors. Michael Morrison is the Director of Technology Services at Saddleback Valley Unified School District. He has to support technology use by 34,000 students, 1,700 teachers, 1,000 staff using 6,000 computers and 280 servers, all with his own team of only 25 people. I put a link in the show notes to the entire story, but the bottom line is that they taught their team to use ScreenSteps Desktop and ScreenSteps Live in less than an hour. They've gotten tons of great feedback from their students, staff, teachers on how useful their documentation is. His staff is documenting more than ever before because it's so easy and enjoyable, and now other districts are actually using Saddleback's documentation because it's so good. You can check out ScreenSteps Live over at bluemangolearning.com/ScreenStepsLive. Of course, there's a link in the show notes. Check that out if you've got a team of people struggling to do online documentation quickly and easily. Now, don't forget to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, when you buy ScreenSteps Desktop. You get 25% off of the purchase price if you do that. Check it out at ScreenSteps.com.
Hey, Allison, Donald from Otaku No Podcast, back with another of my famous reviews. Well, here's the problem. I've got a MiFi. I love the thing. However, its four-hour battery life leaves much to be desired. There are times when I'm literally out and about all day, and the thing only lasts for like half the day before it poops out on me. So I've been looking for a way to extend the MiFi's battery life. In other words, yes, I'm looking for a battery of doom. The first device I looked at is called the Music Power Encore Dual USB Charger with Battery. I heard about this device on one of Leo's podcasts, The Daily Gizwiz. It's about the size and shape of a small pack of cigarettes, about 2.5 by 1.5 by 8.5 inches. It has a flip-out wall plug that you can use to plug it into the wall, and it has two USB ports that you can use to plug in various devices to charge or power them. But here's the kicker. It also has a built-in battery that charges up while you have it plugged into the wall. You can then unplug the device from the wall and take it with you and use the built-in battery to charge whatever USB devices you want. Very handy. Like I said, it has two USB ports, so you can charge or power two USB devices simultaneously. It has an LED that lights up at the press of a button to indicate the amount of battery power left on the built-in battery. Green for almost full, orange for about half full, and red for almost empty. Unfortunately, it did not work with the MiFi. When I plugged the MiFi into the Encore, it acted like it was being charged for about 10 minutes, but then, all of a sudden, the MiFi stopped charging and started using its built-in battery. Kinda lame. I suspect this is because the MiFi is one of those high-drain devices like the iPad. The Encore, however, works beautifully at charging most other USB devices, such as cell phones, iPods, and so on. For example, it has just enough power to fully charge up my Android smartphone in about 3 hours. As such, it's still a very handy device to have around, because there have been times that I've been caught in strange parts of town with a dead cell phone. Not very fun. It's only about $10 and can be found at Amazon and most other online sources. Next, I checked out a device that I heard about on some cell phone forums that I frequent, with the extremely geeky-sounding name of Tekion TechCharge MP1800. It's about the same size as the Encore, maybe a bit taller, about 3.5 by 2 by 1 inches, but it has a kind of a weird curved shape to it. Still, it looks pretty cool. Like the Encore, it also has an LED that lights up to indicate charge status, green for mostly full, orange for about half full, and red for almost empty. It also has a bright white LED that can be used as an LED flashlight. Kind of handy to have, actually. However, unlike the Encore, it only has one USB port on it, so you can only charge or power one USB device at a time. It includes a USB cable with several different tips on it to fit many common types of cell phone as well as iPod. You can also buy additional tips to fit various other USB devices, or since it's a standard USB port, you can just use the whatever USB cable that your device came with. They claim that with the Tekion, you can get 17 hours of talk time on most phones, 46 hours of audio playback, and 11 hours of video playback on an iPod Touch, or a whopping 165 hours of audio or 28 hours of video playback on an iPod Classic. But the real test was the MiFi. I started out with both the Tekion and the MiFi batteries fully charged, and it lasted for over 11 hours. this is pretty awesome, and it indeed qualifies as a battery of doom. Of course, it'll also charge and power other USB devices, and since it works with a MiFi, it has enough oomph to charge high-drain USB devices like the iPad. The only thing I didn't really like about this device is that the documentation that it comes with is kind of misleading. On the instructions that show how to charge up the device, it shows the person plugging it into a little wall wart type of thing, which the package didn't come with. I don't know if this is just an oversight or what, but since it uses a standard USB port, I was able to plug it into my computer and charge it over my computer's USB port. It also works with a little 10-watt power adapter that came with my iPad. So a little disappointing, but I was able to work around that. Aside from that, the Tekion satisfies all of my needs beautifully, and at $37, isn't terribly expensive for what you get. Check out the links that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes for more information.
There is one more thing.
If you're at all curious or interested in Japanese animation or comics, anime or manga, and will be in the San Jose area this coming weekend, May 28th through 31st, you might want to check out FanimeCon. This is a big anime and manga convention that's held every Memorial Day weekend at the San Jose Convention Center. And, as you might have guessed, I will be there. I'm actually going to be putting on a workshop at FanimeCon called Anime Podcasting for Noobs. And yes, as the title implies, I'll be talking about how to create your own podcast. This is sort of like the podcasting on podcasting thing that Allison's did a while ago. So, if you'll be there, check it out. Right now, I'm scheduled for Sunday the 30th at 12 noon, but I don't know what room they're going to put me in. So be sure and look me up in the FanimeCon program guide once you get there. Hope to see you there. Hope you enjoyed the review. I'll see you next time.
That's great, Donald. I wish you the best of luck, and thanks for the reviews on the power chargers that you looked at. I'm intrigued by this category because everybody's always looking for the perfect solution. Sounds like you found a couple of good ones. This week, I decided to try and figure out if I can read library books on the iPad. The iPad uses the EPUB format, and I've heard that they use the EPUB format at some libraries, but I've also been told that the copy protection means it won't work on the iPad. But I decided not to take that as an answer without really digging in. I drove to my local library and got my first library card since I was a kid. Man, it's a real eye-opener to go to the library. Have you seen how much cool free stuff you can get there? It's really astonishing. What an idiot I am. Well, the library gave me a handout that told me how to log in to the online version to get to the ebooks, and that's when the craziness started. You wouldn't believe how complicated they've made it, these things. Every book on the website has a symbol, set of symbols above it designating which kinds of devices you can use for that book. They've got Mac, PC, CD, MP3 player, iPod, and iPad. They gray out the ones you can't have for the particular book you're viewing. Also for each book, they show several formats, three kinds of audiobook formats that don't interest me, and then Adobe DRM'd EPUB, Adobe DRM'd PDF, and Mobi Pocket eBooks. So you've got like 68 degrees of freedom trying to figure out if you're allowed to read the book you want to read. So all you want to do is read a book, right? You have to wade through all these formats. It's virtually impossible to figure out. I took a screenshot for the show notes so you can see how many options you're faced with. I went ahead and downloaded a random book that was in Adobe EPUB format, which to even download made me install some crapola software called Adobe Digital Editions on my Mac. Get this, even the download button on the website was in Flash. Oh well, anything, I'll do anything for an experiment, so I went ahead and did it. I got the book into Editions, and I was able to figure out in the preferences where they store the file. Now, remember Nightwise told us about the document conversion program called Calibre? It runs on Linux, Mac, and Windows, and it's open source, I think. It's free. I think it's open source. Anyway, Calibre will take PDFs and convert them to EPUB format, which makes them much smaller and faster for an ebook reader like the Sony or the Kindle. I was hoping that if I converted the book through Calibre, the copy protection might get scraped off, but that didn't work. I did some searching, and there's someone who's written a Python script to scrape off the DRM. But that was a little bit beyond my talents or inclination to do for every book I wanted to read. I'm afraid I lost my nerve at this point, but I might give it another go, because my friend Matt has done it before, and I bet I can milk a couple hundred hours of help out of him on this. Now, the only glimmer of hope I'm left with here is that they do have an iPad symbol, as I mentioned before, in their lineup of devices. So maybe there's plans to make them work on the iPad eventually, but for now, I think this is a failed experiment. I'm not sure I could get past the annoyance of even figuring out how to find a book to read on the ebook library page, so I'm not really devastated that they don't have an iPad version yet. Somebody remind me to check back in a year or so, though, just in case. I'm so lucky to have Honda Bob here to keep my cars in good order. I don't ever worry about whether I'm going to get stranded on the side of the road, or if I'm paying too much, or if I'm being tricked into unnecessary repairs. If you have a Honda or an Acura, you can have peace of mind like this too, but only if you live in the LA or Orange County areas of California. I know, it's kind of a mean thing to do to tease 95% of the people listening because this is an international podcast, but at least the lucky 5% should get to know about Honda Bob, right? You can engage his services by calling him at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchat from BartB.ie. Practically back from the dead. It's been 3 weeks since I've gotten to talk to you, Bart.
Yeah, I just blew the dust off my microphone. And I wish I was joking.
Oh, that's horrible. No, I think, Nightwise did okay as a, you know, as a last resort and all that last week, didn't you think?
It was a great parachute.
Oh, don't start that again.
I like his tips for securing PDFs, though.
You mean the part where he said, unplug the computer, cut the cord, burn the house down?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to burn the house down, but the uncut the cord should do the trick. It's I have a poster hanging up at work. It's just a little cartoon. You know, it shows hackers in movies, and you see, you know, oh my God, I'm being hacked, and the next frame is him typing at 20 million miles an hour, and if I lock this out, and if I do this, and if I do that, then we'll stop the hacker. And it says, the real world. Oh my God, hackers. And he walks up to the wall, and he pulls out the plug.
Exactly. Oh, well, it certainly is nice to have you back. It's definitely missed you, Bart. Oh, we were talking before we started that we may hear some children and banging outside the window, but that means you have the window open in Ireland.
I have both windows open. I have everything open that can possibly open in this room. It is scorching today. Now, it's not too big in actual numbers. It's 25 Celsius, but it's humid in 25 Celsius, so it's hot.
Wow. Oh, that's 77 degrees. Nice. So you've been outside playing?
Yes, yes. I was out on the bike for the afternoon and doing a fair bit of housework, actually, but had to be done.
Good, good. Well, let's start in. What do we got in Security Light? We've been unsecure for the last couple of weeks.
Well, I don't think too much too exciting happened. I think at this stage it's 3, maybe 4 weeks ago that we mentioned that there had been an update released for Java on all platforms except for the Mac. And it was a fairly significant and serious update. And we all wondered how long it would be till Apple patched it. Well, the answer was about 3 weeks. So Apple have released updates for Java for both 10.5 and 10.6.
So they didn't take forever this time?
Well, it depends on your definition of forever.
Apple time zone normally is months,
yeah.
Right?
Well, it has been known to take 3 months, and this time it took 3 weeks. So arguably they're one order of magnitude better. But 3 weeks is arguably still far too long for something this serious.
Okay. Well, at least
but nonetheless,
here.
Patched, so let it, yeah. It's actually, what's really pleasant is it doesn't even need a reboot, so you can just install it with impunity.
Well, that's good. So when it says, I'd like to install this, say yes.
Exactly. It's probably done so by now already, and you won't even have to reboot, which is always fun.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you'd be proud of me. I've got a dentist who's super, super high-tech. Everything is just crazy high-tech. Like when I'm in there getting my teeth examined, the dental hygienist has a camera that she shoves in my mouth and I can see on screen what's going on inside my mouth. It's highly effective because it's really magnified. So a cavity that isn't big enough that they could ever stick that little poker in it and feel it looks like the Grand Canyon. So you're like, oh my God, fill that immediately, please. but they also, it's all run on Windows, and they've got all, it's a horrible interface. It looks like Soviet war era Windows 98, and it's doing all these different interesting manipulations. You're seeing your teeth fly by, but all of a sudden a thing comes up saying there's a security update to Java, would you like me to install? And I yelled at her to say yes.
Excellent.
I said, well, maybe not you, but make sure someone pushes yes on that.
I'm not sure I want to see what my dentist is at in there.
Yeah.
Does your dentist do that thing where they try to have an entire conversation when they have something in your gob and you're trying to argue back? But
well, I solved it. I put my headphones in and I tell them I'm going to listen to this podcast. Go at it. And I've actually gotten so lulled in listening to things on my iPad, I've actually fallen asleep while she's doing my teeth.
Wow.
Yeah. She puts a nice blanket on me. It's awesome.
Okay. I like your dentist.
Oh, I have a great dentist. Anyway, what else in Security Light?
Yes, the other thing I thought I would mention is MobileMe got an update, which is mostly not security related. But you may remember a long time ago I talked about MobileMe being ridiculously bad and the fact that it didn't use HTTPS for anything but the initial login, which meant that you were completely vulnerable to having your cookie stolen, or indeed all of your email or all of your contacts or anything you did over MobileMe could be intercepted.
Okay.
They've improved things slightly. You now do all your calendaring and everything over HTTPS, but in a fit of utter stupidity, and I can't see any actual reason for doing this, every time you click to go from one app to another, say you go from the tab for your contacts to the tab for your iDisk, it goes to HTTP and then that redirects it back to HTTPS. Which means if you're being attacked by a man in the middle, you have absolutely no protection because they simply won't redirect you to the HTTPS.
Oh, so it's like they forgot a step?
Well, no, it's like they've done a half.
Well, they did part of it and they didn't do the rest of it.
Yeah, there's a phrase here. I'm not sure I can say it as half-assed.
Yeah, we'll allow it.
Okay, because it's common vocabulary over here and not rude.
I think we'll allow it for today.
Someone obviously told them they needed to make this checkbox, and so they made this checkbox. So yes, the app runs over SSL, but no, it doesn't do so safely. It's just stupid.
So I'm flipping right now between mail, calendar, and contacts, and it's not showing HTTP and then flipping to HTTPS. It's showing the S each time?
It's very quick. It's an instant. If you're on a slow connection, you'll spot it. It goes HTTP and then HTTPS again. It's instant. It's an instant redirect. It doesn't load and then reload. It's a 301 redirect. But I did it yesterday a few times just to convince myself I wasn't going mad, and every time I did it on my slow internet connection, I could see HTTP, then HTTPS. And HTTP, then HTTPS.
I'll have to go get a worse connection because at 12 megabits down, it's not showing it to me.
Well, the other possibility is it's been fixed, which would be great.
Oh, that would be nice.
Because, I mean, it is a web app, so they can fix it without having to do any software out to us.
Yeah, I wonder.
I hope that has been fixed. I'll double check again when I'm not recording because I don't want to crunch up my sound. But yesterday evening at 10 p.m., that's what it was doing.
Wow. Okay, well, I hope it's fixed. All right, let's get to our main topic.
Hang on.
We have something fun for today. No?
No. Missed a bullet point there.
Oh, we did? I'm sorry. Oh, yes. No, right.
To warn people, because I got bitten by this, and I most certainly did not get fished or anything like that, but one of my Yahoo accounts got hacked last week.
Oh.
Which means it was probably an attack on the password or some sort of attack on the cookie or something. But I had a password that was alphanumeric, but it was only 6 characters long, so maybe the time has come to go longer than 6.
Oh, wow.
I had myself in my contacts, and I got a spam email from myself to myself.
Oh,
and
that's
every other
good.
Contact in my contact book, all in the 1-2 field, and I was like, oh, great, someone's gotten in.
So did you just change your password and it fixed it?
I reset the password to 1 twice as strong, and I'm hoping that's done the trick.
Good. Yikes.
I also updated my security questions in case they were too easy, because that's another great way they can get in.
Oh, okay. I'll have to.
That's how Sarah Palin hacked.
Didn't she also have the name
one of
her dog?
Where did you meet your husband? And someone put in Wasilla High, and
got in.
Got in, yeah.
Oh, nice.
So you should always lie. Just remember how you lied.
Oh, okay, that's a good idea. If it's something anybody else would know.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's really is the weakest point in there. So there's an option to make your own question. So I always do that and make up a completely ridiculous question. Then a completely ridiculous answer. I just saved the question and the answer as part of my entry in Password Vault. So I just stick it in the note.
One of these days, I'm going to do some better work on my password. Steve and I are getting our nerve up to do it. We'll do it.
Well, right. Once you get hacked once, you'll suddenly have the nerve.
Oh, okay, I'll wait till then. So can we have fun yet?
Yes.
Okay, good.
We talked, I think, at the start of the year that every now and then we would do a topic on how to photograph X or Y that would be seasonally appropriate. I think we started with snow because it was winter and we had a lot of that. And right. Now it isn't winter. But butterfly season has kicked off and I've been spending quite a bit of time taking pictures of butterflies. So I thought, hey, topic.
Oh, and some of your butterfly shots are just stupendous. Oh, we got to remember to put in the show notes some links to some of your photos. Oh, you did put them in. That's what you added at the last minute. Okay, good.
Yes, so there's a link there. Basically, I don't know, and I wouldn't even claim to pretend that this is the best way of taking butterfly shots, but this is what I do. And if you look at my pictures and you think that they're decent, then follow this advice. And if you think they look rubbish, don't.
Okay, you get what you pay for, too.
You get what you pay for. So, the link to the pictures shows you what these instructions lead to, and if you don't like what you see, then there's no point in reading on.
Oh, you shouldn't have showed me that link. I'm paying no attention now. I'm just looking at butterflies.
Oh, no.
All right. So how does one shoot a butterfly with a camera?
I always think, actually, whenever you hear a photography podcast, if the CIA are using like keywords, I think we're all terrorists. They're out, you know, shooting babies and stuff.
Hey, there's a train in here.
What? How did that happen?
There is. There's a train. And you're tagged with butterfly. The NMBSSNCBM6+ class 27.
How did that end up with the wrong keyword on it? That's mad. Because it's based off keywords, so it should have only...
Maybe it's flipping through. I'm getting it wrong because I just got another one. Maybe flipping through the photo stream doesn't work that way. Yeah, I think
that's... Did you flip through the photo stream or did you flip through the tag?
Well, I clicked the link...
Should give you a page with only butterflies.
Right, but then once I had one up, I started hitting next, next, next. That's what I did wrong.
Ah, yes, but that means you're going through my stream, not through this tag.
All right, let's get back to actually...
Okay, sorry.
I'll stop playing here.
I thought I'd messed up my metadata, and I'm such a picky person on metadata. I thought we'd break this into three bits, the before, the during, and the after.
Okay.
For want of a better term. So prep, taking the shot, and then processing the shot. So the first thing to say is it helps so, so very, very, very much to actually know what species of butterfly exists in your part of the world.
Hmm. Okay.
In Ireland, that is a total of 28. I have no idea what that is in California.
Wow.
But okay. You guys probably have really cool ones like monarchs and stuff that we don't have.
Somewhere. California isn't great for, or we're at my part of California. Up in Santa Barbara, they've got the, remember Tim of butterfly poop?
Okay. Fame. How could one forget butterfly poop?
Butterfly poop Tim. Yeah, he's those are monarchs up there, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. So a bit of reading up front to know what there is, and then the different butterflies will hang around different places, and they'll hang around at different times of the year. So I mean, you know, for much of the year there ain't no butterflies around, and then you know, then some of them will be caterpillars, while other of them will be flying around. So it's good to know which ones are flying around when and where they like to live. Do they like to live in gardens? Do they like to live near water? Do they like meadows? Do they like marshes? Do they like forests?
Oh.
Because if it's a time of year where the only butterflies around are in a forest and you're standing in a meadow, you're in for a disappointing day.
Okay.
So getting to know the different species and where they like to hang out is definitely a good idea, and getting to know when they like to hang out there. And really, there's no substitute, I find, for just getting to know a place. So I like to keep fit because I need to. So I do a mountain bike run every day that's about 7 mile. Wow. And it's along a stretch of the Royal Canal, which means that it's through nature. And it's quite a varied bit of nature, too. So I just go up and down there every day, and it's 7 miles. But it means I really get to know what species of butterfly hang out there. So I keep an eye out, and then I say to myself, oh, look, the common blue is out, and it likes to hang around to the 13th lock, which means that tomorrow I'm going to bring my camera and hang around here for a bit and then hopefully get some nice pictures. And then a few weeks later, it might be the meadow brown, which likes to hang around at the 15th lock, and then I'll head over there. But if you're always up and down there, you'll see how, you know, in April it starts off with the orange tips, and then later on we get the whites, and then a little later on we might get Painted Lady. And you'll watch the species develop, and then you'll know where and when to be. So just, you know, getting to know your local park or getting to know somewhere is a good idea.
And the fact that you do it on a bike is why you can see things, because you wouldn't see it if you were going by in a car.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Arguably, you miss stuff on the bike too. But I guess walking is the best way to get to know any place. But I'm not going to walk 7 miles every day.
Right, right,
it's just not happening. I don't mind mountain biking it. Now, the nice thing, of course, if you're mountain biking is you're going a bit slower anyway because you can't be going at 50 mile an hour.
Right, right. Okay, so now we know what butterflies we have and we know where they live.
Yes, so the next thing is actually taking the picture. A lot of people's first impulse would be to use a macro lens.
Well, I would think so. You want to get a macro shot, right?
Yeah, and you might think to yourself, oh, those cool eyes with all the funny cells and stuff and the cool little detail on the wing. And that is definitely true, assuming you're going somewhere like a zoo or a butterfly house where the butterflies don't mind the people so much. In which case, you can stick a lens 10 centimeters away from the butterfly to get your macro shot. But in the real world, they're all little scaredy cats, and they don't like you being near them.
Ah, okay.
So a macro lens is sod all use to you out in the wild, because you're never going to get close enough to use it.
I guess that makes sense.
It'll sod off. So what I find is a stonking zoom is the way to go.
I have trouble picturing a butterfly and say sod off. I don't know. That is not right.
They have big long tongues, so I guess they go...
Okay, that I'll buy.
So I have found that a stonking zoom is the way to go, because then even if you're still 3 yards away from the bleeding thing, at least you can get close enough to get a picture.
Okay.
And if you're lucky, you can get to like a yard away, and then you can get a really good picture.
Isn't it hard to hold it still zoomed up that far, though?
Well, that's what I was going to say. The key here is to get a zoom to the limit that you can handhold, because you're not going to have a chance to lug around the tripod.
Right.
You're going to be out in the middle of nature, and the butterfly is going to be flying from flower to flower to flower, sitting down for 10 seconds and then sodding off. And if you have a tripod, you're not going to get anywhere. So 200 millimeters is easy to handhold in a crop sensor. That'd be equivalent to 300 on a full-frame sensor, which I'm not sure many of our listeners are lucky enough to have. If you have a VR lens with vibration reduction built in, which would be, it's called VR on the Nikons, and I think it's called IS for image stabilization on the Canons.
Oh, I always wondered what the IS stood for. Okay.
Yeah, it's image stabilization. So it's the same as VR. If you have one of those lenses, you can probably get away with a 300 millimeter. But the key is you have to be able to hold it by hand.
Right.
So zoom as much as you can without needing a tripod is, in my experience, the way to go. Now, I have the same 55-200 zoom from Nikon that you have, and I love it to bits, and that's the lens I use for pretty much every single one of those butterfly shots.
Now, I always thought you had to use a macro lens to get that shallow depth of field until one time I was really far from my... No, I remember. I had my 55-200 millimeter lens on at a cross-country meet because I've been taking pictures of the kids far away, and then my son and his girlfriend posed for a photo, and I realized, oh, my God, I got the wrong lens on, but I knew Kyle's attention span for this was about 30 seconds, so he wouldn't let me switch to the other lens. So I just backed way the heck up and then zoomed way in on it, and it was fabulous in shallow depth of field.
Yes, the zoom lens has that compressing effect, which means that you do get a really shallow depth of field. What you would think is that you got to open this lens wide up to try to get your shallow depth of field, but because you're going to be getting as physically close to the butterfly as you can with this stonking big zoom, your problem is actually the opposite. Your depth of field is going to be so small that you're going to want to go to f8 or f11 to try open it up enough to get the bleeding thing all in focus.
Okay.
Because they seldom hold their wings perfectly flat, so you want your depth of field to be a couple of centimeters, or an inch or two if you can. So actually that means you're probably working at f8 or f11, which is really counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't have thought that.
Because you would think f1.4 for the win, but no. It's the closer you get to something, the shallower your depth of field gets, and the more you zoom in, the shallower your depth of field gets. So if you get as close as you can with a big zoom, the effect is really dramatic and your depth of field just shrinks away to nothing.
Oh, cool.
So you counteract that by opening it back up again to F8 or F11. F11 works best, but you probably won't have enough light to get away with that. So F8 very often works.
Okay.
I find I always work in aperture priority for this. So stick it in A mode and stick her down to F8 or F11, whatever I can get away with. And just keep an eye on the exposure time that it's automatically choosing based on that aperture.
So what can you handhold?
With a 200 millimeter zoom, on a good day, if I haven't had too much coffee, I can just about get away with 1 over 250. But to be honest, that's really the outer edge. I like to keep it at 1 over 300 or 1 over 400 if possible.
Oh, wow. I thought you could hold like 160.
Okay, but it's 60. If I had it at 160 millimeters, then I could hold it at 160th, but we're going to 200 millimeters.
Oh, there's that math again. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll just believe you.
Well, no, the more you zoom in, the quicker you have to go because your shaking is being magnified by zooming.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so if you were, you know, if you had it zoomed all the way out at 18 millimeter or something, I mean, you can handhold 1/20th of a second if you haven't had your coffee. Right. But, you know, we're zoomed in all the way here.
Important
so
distinction.
I really find 2/50th is really, you're really trusting to look. What can help is put the camera in rapid fire mode and just fire off three at a time. So the first one, your finger's in the process of pushing down, so you're giving a bit of camera shake. And the last one, your finger's in the process of lifting up, so you're giving a bit of camera shake. But that middle one should be quite good.
Oh, that's a good trick to think about. I've only ever used stuff like that on like on cross-country meets or track meets where they're flying by. I figure I'll catch them once with their eyes shut and once with their foot looking like it's bent inside out or something, and then one good shot. I would have never thought about it, something sitting still.
Yes. So it means that you're not, because as you're lifting up and down your finger, you move the camera a bit. So if you hold it down for three, your middle one tends to be better.
Okay, interesting.
So if you have a big enough memory card, you know, it's good to do that. They're not going to sit still for long. So you will see me quite often wandering around with a big zoom lens held like a gun, waiting for one of them to sit down and then quickly get off a few shots and then off we go again.
So there's a lot more waiting, I would guess, with trying to do butterflies than there is shooting?
It's not so much waiting, it's walking. So you find one and you follow it until the bleeding thing sits still. And then you try to get some shots, and then you follow it again until it's still again. So you sort of find yourself walking up and down as you're following a butterfly.
Okay.
So you look like a bit of an idiot if you're in a park or something, but I don't care.
Sorry, it's a great visual.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you get to see it in person in the summer.
All right.
The other thing I should say is that it's very important to get the head of the butterfly in focus. If the wings are, the tips of the wing are slightly out of focus, you really won't notice. It's like if you're taking a portrait, you got to get the eye, got to get the butterfly's head. Otherwise, it will look wrong.
So even at f8 or f11, you've got the depth of field is that shallow.
Yes. Now, if they have their wings flat, be that either fully open or fully closed, you're fine. But if they have their wings sort of half up, then that becomes an issue where you're going to lose the tips of the wings, but it doesn't really matter.
Oh, okay.
As long as you get the head in focus. And to do that, you really need to put your camera into spot focus mode where it's focusing off a single autofocus point and you choose the point it focuses on and you choose the middle one.
Yeah, we're going to go through that in a future lesson, right?
We're going to go through the many options you have and why you might use them in a different lesson. But for this case, what you want is point focus, and you want to choose the center point. And the reason you choose the center point is because it's the most accurate. Your focus points tend to have only one axis, with the exception of the center one, which is a cross, which means it has two axes. So it's a better focus point than the other ones.
Okay.
Now, in the case of the D40 we have a grand total of three focus points. So it's the best of three, but some people will have 9 or 12 or many, many more. But you pick the center one, it's always the best.
After a while, that seems just goofy, don't you think, when they keep adding more and more focal points?
Because I only ever use... My camera is permanently set on spot focus, and it's always the middle focus point I use.
I think mine's gotten flipped off of that. I got to check that. Okay.
So, basically, center it on the head and shoot that way. And then you can recrop and post to get the composition you want. You just absolutely, positively must have the head in focus. So the only way to reliably do that is spot focus and put the spot on the head. By default, most cameras will focus on whatever is closest to the camera, which means wingtips.
Oh, so that's why you have to force it to look at a different spot?
Yeah. The default behavior out of the box on almost every camera I've ever picked up is you autofocus on the closest point to the camera that's in the shot, which will be the wingtips in this case. Or if there's some sort of blade of grass between you and the butterfly, it'll actually try to focus back on the blade of grass rather than on the butterfly behind it. It gets immensely annoying immensely quickly. So that's why I say spot focus, stick it on the butterfly's head.
There you go.
If you want to maximize how much is sharp, try always be perpendicular to the butterfly.
Oh, good
point. Not at an oblique angle, but try get perpendicular. So if his wings are closed, get straight to the side of him and hit him exactly side on. And if you want to get him with the wings open, straight down from above.
Now, is there going to be an advanced class of this version? Because I noticed one of your photos, the butterfly is not only not flat, he's upside down with his wings closed, flying.
Yeah, that was called luck.
Okay. I was going to say, that's violating everything you just taught us.
No, these are what I, okay, what I actually said in the show notes that I should have said here too, is that these are your safe shots. So you get your perfect perpendicular shots, and they will come out as good shots of the species of butterfly. And you'll be able to look at them and say, that is the great red butterfly or whatever of your local place. Once you have those, and you have some nice shots, and you're kind of happy, then there's no point in going for the safe shot. Then you can be adventurous try with, you know, half open wings and all these kind of cool things. And then you can really try cool stuff. But to get your first few shots that actually look good, keep it perpendicular, because that means that the plane of focus is going to fall parallel to the plane of the wings. So the whole wing is going to be in focus, or none of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. You either get it or you don't.
You either get it or you don't, exactly. But once you start to have the wing at any sort of an angle to the plane of focus, then only bits of the wing are going to intersect the plane of focus, because it's parallel to your lens. So if the butterfly is at an angle to your lens, you're going to have a slice of focus through the butterfly, but not all of it. And then the slice might be an inch thick, but if it's a big butterfly and the angle's a lot, then an inch isn't enough. And, you know, now that can result in some really nice effects. But for your safe shots, keep them perpendicular to the wing.
Okay. And you said, I think you mentioned in the show notes that the reason you want to be on the head is if the wings are in focus and the head is out of focus, it just looks stupid. But the other way around looks like it's, wow, that's crazy how shallow that depth of field is.
Yeah, the other way around can look really cool. And I have some examples of that if you look through the photo stream. And also what can be really cool that you don't see very often is sort of face on to the butterfly. So you're not looking down on his wings, you're looking into his eyeballs. That can be kind of nice, but that's really difficult. Very small point to focus on, and the little boogers don't like to sit still. But it can be great when it works, though.
That's right, because they're busy going as they fly away.
Pretty much. Something to bear in mind, actually, in the bigger butterflies in the evenings tend to not have much energy left, and you tend to find them sunbathing on rocks or paths to try soak up enough body heat to do their thing. So they're the perfect opportunities to get some good shots, because they're in no humor for flying anywhere. They're sitting there with their wings open, presenting the beautiful bit of the wing to you. So that's often really nice, actually.
That's interesting. So are they about to die at that point, or is it just they're...
No, it's
they
just...
They go to sleep.
It's before they go to sleep, they like to sunbathe to charge up the old batteries. Look at the wings as being giant big solar panels.
I bet they're pretty good at that, yeah.
Yeah, so the blood flows through the wings and it gets heated up. So they're literally soaking up heat. And so they'll go lie with their wing pointing at the sun, so it's lit perfectly, and they'll just sit there and they'll be very docile. So great opportunity. The one thing that will make them fly away instantly is if you get in their light. If your shadow crosses them, they will sod off in an instant. So you've got to walk around them in a big enough arc that your shadow never lands on them, and then sneak up to them from in such a way that the shadow doesn't fall on them, and then you can get to your lens's minimum focusing distance.
Hey, I just found a website that could make all of this much easier. If you're in Southern California, it's a site that tells you what plants to plant in your garden to get which butterflies to show up.
That's it. Okay, yeah, you could go looking for them, or you could attract them to you.
And then we just cut out that whole 7-mile ride.
Yeah, I needed the ride anyway.
Getting no exercise, right?
It's also good, actually. Every butterfly has its food plants. So if you know what the food plants are and you know where those plants grow, then you're in business. A lot of Irish butterflies like nettles, which I wouldn't grow in my garden, but I do know where they grow in the wild.
Now, nettles, from my childhood experience with them, are nasty little plants that if you rub up against them, you itch for hours.
Well, in Ireland, they have stinging nettles, so you get little round bubbles on your skin. Because basically, they have teeny tiny little, actually, glass fluff on their wing that goes into your skin and breaks off and injects some poison.
Nice.
Yeah. Pretty unpleasant stuff, nettles. So, you know, stand clear. Wearing shorts is often a bad idea when you're chasing after butterflies.
Sounds like it. All right, so that's it. Now we have a perfect picture?
Well, that's the in-camera bit. So the last thing is just a few quick little tips for what you do afterwards.
Okay.
So something which you want to do is you want the butterfly to really pop out of the picture. You don't really want the background to take precedence over the butterfly. And a lot of the time when you're finished processing the shot, if you're doing your basic aperture edits, whatever you do affects the whole photograph. So you may want to get it looking almost right, or, you know, get it looking pretty good. And then as just a last little finishing touch, if you're using Aperture 2, go into the Dodge and Burn plugin and add a little brightness contrast and saturation to just the butterfly, which would just lift it up a little bit and make it a little bit more vibrant than the rest.
Now, in Aperture 2, can you do that? How do you do it just to the butterfly?
You use the Dodge and Burn plugin.
Oh, okay. So it gives you a little brush to work with?
Yeah, with the Dodge and Burn plugin, you get a brush, and you can choose whether you're brushing brightness, darkness, saturation, desaturation. There's lots of things you can choose. But basically, what you want to brush on is you want to lighten it, add some contrast, and add some saturation. Those three together make it really pop. They really make butterfly look vibrant and bright and not washed out. Because if you don't add in the contrast, you'll get a washed out butterfly. You want the blacks of the butterfly to be black, you want the brights to be bright, and you want the color to really sing.
Now,
and if you do that subtly...
I was going to say, well, I was going to give you the straight line for that. You were saying if you do that subtly. I've noticed that with your photos, they look realistic. They look like this could have looked this way. So it doesn't. You're not doing it to the point where it's like, you know, crazy colors that wouldn't have ever happened in nature.
Yes. So if are you on the first page there?
Could be.
Well, if you click on the link again, you will be. And if you go down then to the fourth row and the third one in, you have a red
butterfly. That's the one I was looking at. That's exactly the one I was looking at.
That one has had that treatment applied, but it's been applied in such a way that it doesn't look like it's been applied.
Yeah, yeah. No, it doesn't at all.
And it's before it was applied, the butterfly was just a hint underexposed, but the bokeh was right. So I could either make the bokeh not look as good, or I could just selectively brighten the butterfly and make the butterfly pop that little bit better.
I hope this doesn't open a whole new line of discussion, but what's bokeh again? You told us before.
It's the out-of-focus bit.
Oh, okay, good, good. The shallow depth of field.
Yeah, so that nice, soft out-of-focus bit is the bokeh.
Okay.
So if you have Aperture 3 or Lightroom 3, you can do this with a brush adjustment, so you can just brush in those adjustments without having to go through a plugin. By the way, the Dodge and Burn plugin comes free with Aperture 2, so it's not something you have to buy.
Oh,
it's
good.
It's just there.
Okay.
So you just right-click on the photo and go Edit with Dodge and Burn.
Oh, I never noticed that before.
Okay.
You can do it in Aperture 3 where it takes a half hour for it to finish painting that brush in.
Okay. Yeah, well, in Aperture 3, I would honestly just use the basic brushes adjustment. I wouldn't run it through the plugin.
Yeah, but that's good to know. So brightness, saturation, contrast. Got it.
Yeah, those three are the key. Then the other thing which you can do is a lot of the time you have a fairly big dynamic range kicking in here, and especially if the butterflies are white. So I find that Topaz Adjust is just the king of getting the detail back in the bright whites. Because with the bright whites, the detail is all very bright. So if you want to bring out the detail, you'd be tempted to kind of lower the exposure, but then it looks underexposed.
Right.
So then you bring the exposure up again, and then it looks washed out. Well, with Topaz Adjust, it will selectively darken just the bits that need to be darkened to give it proper contrast. So it'll still look properly exposed, but it will bring that detail back out. So that's the adaptive exposure slider is what you're looking at in Topaz Adjust. And then the region slider directly below it will sort of define how that adaptive exposure is applied. So those two sliders do the main work.
Okay.
It can also be nice to add in just a little bit of detail boost. So there's a boost slider under the detail section. Uh-huh. Just a little bit of detail can help. Don't get carried away. And also a little bit of a boost under the color section, a little saturation boost might work nicely too.
I like you giving us specifics on this. Now, Topaz Adjust was one of those plugins that you had to buy. I don't think it was terribly expensive. I know you got a whole set of them, but that's the one Steve gave me. But I go in and there's just so many controls, I don't know what to do. I start poking things and pretty much I go, well, now it looks ridiculous and I leave it. But giving me specific guidelines there, I'd like to try that.
Yes, the adaptive exposure and the region slider below it are the two most important sliders in the whole of Topaz Adjust.
I could use that on that white rose photo I took too.
Absolutely.
It's a well taken photo, but it just needs something. So maybe I'll try it on that white rose.
Yeah. Yeah, white roses, white butterflies, all those kind of things with this detail and bright areas that you're not really seeing and you wish you were. Those two sliders are just king. Those two sliders are pretty much all I use in Topaz Adjust. They rock.
Oh, cool. Good. Now I've got a
all the rest is just window dressing for those two.
Can't wait to try that. But if I start up Aperture now, it'll stop my machine. So
I was going to say not a good idea. The other thing I would say is I tend to use these plugins from within a version of Photoshop, because what tends to happen with butterfly shots in particular is you do this and it really makes the butterfly look fantastic, but it will make the bokeh look not smooth and creamy like you want, but Hey, Naviki, because you've tried to add in detail and contrast. It's something that should be no detail and no contrast.
Hmm.
So I tend to selectively apply the adjustment to just the butterfly and perhaps the flower it's sitting on.
So do you cut them out and make separate layers of them and work on them then in Photoshop?
It depends on if I, what I actually do, because I hate doing that. I much prefer to work with layer masks, but Photoshop Elements doesn't have layer masks. Mm-hmm. So I tend to do the adjustment and export it as a TIFF and then export the original as a TIFF, take the two of them into Pixelmator and just do a layer mask between them.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
It sounds a lot of work, but it's literally a few clicks. Hmm. It takes seconds.
Okay.
And once you have them as a layer mask, it's much easier to paint with a soft-edged brush. And if you use a soft-edged brush, you get no horrible, sharp transition from one to the other. So just paint in just the butterfly and the flower, and then you'll just see the detail come through where you've painted.
I see.
And then send it back to Aperture when you're done as a TIFF.
Well, that explains why your butterfly photos look fantastic.
If you go back to that page, the initial page, and you look at the very, very first one, that mm-hmm. is one that was done using that technique, where the bokeh was left alone, but the white butterfly and the flower that it's sitting on were given that little bit of more punch using Topaz Adjust.
I see.
And the same goes for the second one, which is the one sitting on the yellow flare.
Those are both cool. I can just spend the afternoon clicking on these photos. Well, I don't think anybody's going to look at those and say they're ick and not want to follow your suggestions. This is really fun. This makes me want to go out and find some butterflies. I don't think we have a lot of butterflies, though.
I'm sure if you do a bit of Googling, you'll know what they like.
Yeah. I would say probably every 3 or 4 months I will see a butterfly.
Well, to be honest, if I were to sit out in my back garden, I wouldn't see many either. But once I know where to go for them, I can pretty much guarantee to find them.
Well, remember, we don't have any, like...
Nature
where I live. A bit more pavement than nature. All right, okay. Bart. Well, this was really fun. I really enjoyed this. Are we on for next week, or we still don't know?
We still don't know. I need to go home to my parents sometime soon because I haven't seen them in quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And being sick meant that I was supposed to miss last weekend, not because I was sick, but because I was going to my parents. And then I got sick, so that was the end of that.
All right. Well, we will be standing by. I'll be... God, I hope I don't have to talk to Nightwise again, though. Jeez. That's bad.
You can't reuse a parachute.
Exactly. Can't keep pulling out that emergency chute. All right. Yeah, well,
unless you can stuff it back into the packaging, but
I don't know if I'm ready to pack them up yet. All right, Bart. Well, I really appreciate this. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to go out and find something to photograph. That's for sure.
Well, the same theory works on flowers a lot as well.
Oh, good. I know where those are.
they should be everywhere. Actually, just to say, congratulations on 5 years, and sorry I wasn't able to be there in person last week.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I was there in the chat room, but...
Yeah, it was a little weird not having you on the five-year show, but I still appreciate your sentiments.
You got to read out my writings, which are written in the doctor's office, actually.
Oh, jeez.
My iPhone, which is why they were short.
Well, that was a lot of writing for an iPhone.
It was a long queue.
Oh, dear. All right, Bart, well, we will talk to you when we talk to you then.
Until next time, happy computing.
Well, I'm afraid it's time to say goodbye, but it sure was great to have Bart back. I missed him. I hope you'll stop by the live chat room one of these weeks. The folks in there are really friendly and silly and welcoming. It's just fun in there. This week, Shai and Apple Hockey made it for the first time, and they seem to be having a ball in there already. Check out the live show at podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m., I think it's GMT minus 7 on Sunday nights. It's Pacific time. I know that for sure. Stay in touch during the week by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com, especially those questions that you think are too dumb to ask. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.